is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flincher.
Well, Margaret, I see the Department of Health and Human Services is taking an active interest in the world of medical research, having convened a two-day meeting to create a clear path forward on ways to keep human subjects safe in the world of biomedical research.
Well, this is a rapidly expanding world, Mark, in this era of big data computing and large-scale participation through platforms like Apple Research Kit, 23andMe, and patients like me. All of these things are contributing to a more robust research culture, and more motivated patients are becoming linked with researchers through these online portals.
There's so much great opportunity for discovery here, Margaret, but also some elevated risk. Researchers are now able to tap into a much larger group of randomized trials, but there are ethical considerations that need to be reevaluated and redefined. HHS wants to ensure that those participants who are selected for clinical trials, especially for life-threatening conditions such as HIV or cancer, are given access to their data as well as access to outcomes.
Well, that's right. And HHS wants to ensure that there is a very clear chain of command on who actually controls and has access to the medical data that's being offered for research. And this is something that our guest today is very passionate about.
John Wilbanks has been an ardent advocate for opening up scientific research, those seeking research information locked up behind paywalls, as well as those who are seeking it to become citizen scientists.
And in the age of the Precision Medicine Initiative and the growing amount of health data floating into the marketplace from wearables and self-tracking devices, I think this is a very important topic, Mark. How do we facilitate the sharing of data while at the same time protecting patient privacy and the integrity of the research at the same time? It's a big order.
It really is. And Laurie Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love hearing from you. Now we'll get to our interview with John Wilbanks in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The Commonwealth Fund has released a comprehensive report on the costs of employer health coverage, which, not surprisingly, varies widely across the country. The report ranked states based on the average amount of the employee premium, the amount defrayed by the employer, as well as the level of deductibles. Employees' contributions to their health insurance premiums rose more slowly between 2010 and 2015 in 30 states and Washington, D.C., and their deductibles grew more slowly in 27 states. Still, many families are spending on average a bigger share of their income on health care than they were prior to 2010. That's because median incomes, despite their recent surge, have not kept pace with health care costs. Southerners more likely to die from smoking-related illness than in any other geographic region in the U.S. A report issued by the American Cancer Society revealed about 40% of cancer deaths in the South were smoking-related, compared to about 8% in other parts of the country. While smoking prevalence has declined in recent years down to 15% of the overall population, smoking rates are noticeably higher in states that don't enact basic public policy interventions, like higher excise tax on cigarette purchases, banning smoking in public places, and reducing nicotine in cigarettes to non-addictive levels. The study estimates at least 28.6% of U.S. cancer deaths in 2014 were linked to smoking. That translates to 167,000 lives that could have been saved. The Veterans Administration may have stumbled on a scalable solution in their quest to reduce long wait times for patients. According to a Kaiser Health News report, vets regularly get next day and even same day appointments for primary care now, no longer waiting a month or more to see a doctor as many once did. Clinical pharmacists have special training that permits them to prescribe drugs, other lab tests, make referrals to specialists, and do physical examinations, and they're handling the chronic care needs of more and more patients. It seems to be paying off. This frees physicians to concentrate on new patients and others with more complex needs. The VA underwent a major overhaul after a whistleblower revealed a couple of years ago a culture of extremely long wait times that led to untimely deaths and many poor outcomes. The VA has made a pledge to veterans seeking care. They shouldn't have to wait longer than 30 days for an appointment. And old blood is okay blood, it turns out. A study published in the New England Journal of Medicine showed that transfusions of newly drawn blood versus blood that had been stored for more than 40 days showed no real difference in outcomes, a 9% mortality rate across the board. Clinicians have long felt that blood stored for more than a few weeks was less effective in transfusions. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with John Wilbanks, Chief Commons Officer at Sage BioNetworks, a collaborative of network partners dedicated to redefining how openly shared data will transform biomedical research. He's also a senior fellow at Faster Cures. Mr. Wilbanks launched Consent to Research in 2011, a platform for people to donate their health data for scientific and medical research. He served at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, worked at the Science Commons and Creative Commons, an open science effort aimed at freely shared scientific and medical data. He won numerous distinctions and was named a global game changer by the Utney Reader. He earned his undergraduate degree in philosophy at Tulane. Mr. Wilbanks, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
You've been a strong advocate for the past two decades for people interested in accessing and sharing their medical data. And we've had a number of your friends and colleagues on who as well have been advocating for that, from Dr. Francis Collins, who's heading up NIH, patient activist E. Patient Dave, all advocating for a similar version of open access to patient data. And there is this growing chorus of people demanding that scientific studies, especially those supported by the government, should be made readily available for people to access.
Science has been, for a very long time, at least since the 1940s in the United States, the way that we do biomedical research and biomedical science has been one in which the government gives money to academic institutions, studies that take a long time. They write those studies up as papers. Those papers get published. The expectation is that the market will find ways to translate the things that are published in the journals and get those back out to the citizens. What it's created is a system that is quite glacially slow to change, and it hasn't really picked up many of the things that the internet makes possible. When you sort of look at it at the top level, there is bureaucratic inertia that runs through the system in the way that we review grants and give money away. You see it when you look at the ethical review processes that happen before clinical studies, where often the forms that are being used are forms that were developed 10, 15, 20 mm-hmm. years ago. And then we haven't had a lot of systems design thinking about, well, how would we redo this? In many cases, we tinker around the edges. We try to change the way that we access the articles that get published. We try to use mobile phones to do mobile clinical studies. But the real power comes when we can link all of those things up together. We have to start designing systems that are as self-reinforcing and in many ways intersectional with it themselves as the current system, or we won't be able to replace it with one that's sort of more modern.
Well, John, you have been tackling this problem from a number of angles in your works at the Scientific Commons and Creative Commons, and these entities have been advocating for open sharing of data for a couple of decades now. And how would you characterize the progress that you have made so far? What do we see?
I was very fortunate to be around some of the ideas that Larry Lessig had, and around those sorts of theorists, I got exposed to a lot of the ideas of the commons. And while I was there, I sort of became fascinated with how these things attached to science. A lot of these concepts of the way that we build knowledge products like software or encyclopedias could be applied to the way that we build knowledge products in science, because that's really what science is about, is the construction of knowledge products. And it always felt like there was a really clean, elegant fit, at least at a theoretical level, because when you get down into the weeds, you run into a very messy reality that science is not nearly as methodologically clean as it thinks it is. Working at Creative Commons, we were very fortunate to be sort of the skunk works. We were exploring how would you share data, given that copyright doesn't attach to data, so you can't use the same licensing methods that you use in software or for Wikipedia. How do you share things like biological materials? That's when I started thinking about the system problem. About six, seven years ago, I started to get obsessed with informed consent, because it looked increasingly like one of those leverage points where individual citizens actually had some leverage that could unstick some pieces of the system. And if we could put that into context, with people doing data collection, with people doing data analysis, we might have a chance to start building a system that works a little better than the existing.
Well, and let me pick up on that concept of informed consent, because if we're going to do clinical trials, we need patients, and to get patients, we need informed consent. Walk our listeners through sort of the historical context of informed consent and how it's evolved.
You know, historically speaking, informed consent has been around for a while. You can trace it back, you know, at least to the early 1900s, to some of the yellow fever work done in the Caribbean. You know, in a modern sense, what we found when we did some of our research at SAGE, and we're a nonprofit biomedical research organization, and everyone we talked to loved informed consent. They loved the idea. They loved the ethics behind it. But a lot of people despaired for the way that it actually happened in reality. No one had time to explain the documents to the people that were signing them. The documents were written in a format that made them very hard to understand. They were often written by attorneys. You know, they don't write the cleanest English necessarily for people who are in a stressful situation and don't have a lot of time to read a document. And there seemed like an opportunity that if you took some of the concepts that were sort of initiated back at Berkman and Creative mm-hmm. Commons about human-readable contracts, that there was an opportunity to start creating, you know, layperson-readable summaries of these very complex documents. And that gave us an opportunity to translate some of those to the screen. Unfortunately, when you do that, you also run into two extra issues. One is that we're sort of used to clicking OK to get to things mm-hmm. that we want. And the other is that even if we do read it, the evidence that's available indicates that physiologically we don't read the same way on screens that we do on paper. And so we've built a series of essentially interface tools that allow us to create visual summaries of consent documents. And we put all that in front of the signing of a document because we don't expect people to actually read the long form, because the evidence just shows that they won't, and even if they do, that they probably won't process it.
Well, you've said that creating a massive open database of health and genomic information doesn't have to be particularly complex. And in your TED Talk, you note that such open platforms require four simple elements. So I'm going to ask you to tell us what they are, but also how does the explosion of personal health data mining devices fit into your thoughts about how these open platforms for health information sharing can function?
What I tend to be biased towards are systems that are, what I say, are simple, weak, open, and together. And so weak doesn't mean weakness. Simple doesn't mean simplistic, and open doesn't mean, you know, unpaid necessarily. A weak system, for example, would be like HTML. As a language for formatting and displaying content, HTML is a relatively weak one. And that means that you don't break future things that might add power to it. So because it was weak, it was extensible. And so the idea is that if we're going to build, you know, a system like this, we should be humble and assume that we don't have all of the answers and build it in a way that it can be extended by other people. Simplicity is the same concept. You don't want to do more than you need to do. I worked for a little while at the Web Consortium on the Semantic Web team for Tim Berners-Lee, and one of the rules inside the Web Consortium is what's called the rule of least power, which is when in doubt, use the least powerful tool that solves the job. And I think that that's a concept that we can really bring forward from the web design world mm-hmm. into the legal design world. And then the idea that things need to be open, you know, it doesn't mean that they're free or unpaid. It means that they're non-discriminatory. It means that that the rules are clear and can be taken forward. Open might be something like open source software, but in many ways something like water or electricity are things that are utility functions. Those are things that were available to anyone that was a participant in the system. And then the together part is more to indicate that if we're going to do this without consuming a massive amount of resources and then charging a lot of rent, we have to build it ourselves. If we wait for the Encyclopedia Britannica, it's going to be quite expensive and they're going to sell it back to us. Whereas if we build it together, it'll be more like Wikipedia. It'll be something that we own together, something that we can change together, something that we can use together.
We're speaking today with John Wilbanks, Chief Commons Officer at Sage BioNetworks, a collaborative of network partners dedicated to redefining how openly shared data will transform biomedical research. Mr. Wilbanks launched Consent to Research in 2011. John, you know, we've got stage two of meaningful use that allows an individual to get access to their data, to view it, to download it, to transmit data to someone else, right? You've got Sync for Science working hard. You all at your company are also working on the same. Walk the consumer through all of these changes that are coming on grab my information and do everything I want to do with it.
You know, in many ways, all of these things that you've mentioned come together to the context of empowering the individual to get a copy of what's known about them, whether it's our medical records, whether it's our ability to order our genomes. It's the capacity to profile us in ways that haven't been possible, and then the right to get a copy of it. And no one really knows what it's going to be like when all of these things really gel. They're very close to gelling. I don't think they've quite gelled yet. You know, I can't sort of just log on, put in my provider ID and my group number and get my EHR yet. I have to send an email to my provider. They send it back as a PDF, right? And, you know, what it means is that, you know, first of all, we're going to have more power. That's the point of empowerment. But we're also going to have a lot more obligations and a lot more opportunities to make mistakes. You know, I'm more savvy than most folks in this area. I don't know what to do with my genome. You know, I wouldn't know what to do with my EHR. And so I think that what we're going to need to have happen as the system gels that lets us get access to this and send this data around, we're going to need to have a marketplace, an ecosystem emerge of interpretation tools that help us understand what these things mean for our daily life, you know, what choice should I make when I get insurance next time, but also, you know, who's a trustable recipient? Who should I actually send my EHR to through Sync for Science? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I would like to see is some kind of member-owned collective or co-op or credit union-style organizational structure emerge, or even something like a land trust where, you know, if you and I share common goals, maybe we both have the same disease, maybe our kids have the same disease, we can pool our data with a bunch of like-minded people and manage it together. Because in the end, I do not keep my money in my mattress. I keep it in a bank. And my expectation is that that's where we're going to wind up as consumers. And so I tend to think that there's going to be an ecosystem that springs up to meet the function when the function is there. And, you know, my hope is that we can shape that ecosystem in a way that it's not just venture-backed companies who want to make 10x returns or 100x returns, that some of this is about, you know, member ownership and governance mechanisms that are appropriate to you and me because we share the same goals.
So, John, I'd like to ask you about a project that we are all hearing a lot about and engaged with, and that is the National Institutes of Health Precision Medicine Initiative, spearheaded by Dr. Francis Collins, the man who oversaw the Human Genome Project. Dr. Collins has called for 1 million citizen scientists to participate in this very bold venture to accelerate the pace of research and to make sure that it is inclusive of everybody. We'd love to hear your comments on the kind of infrastructure that's going to be required to pull this off. How can efforts like Blue Button help us move towards the goals of precision medicine? And what do you think is going to be done to build a more robust infrastructure that allows for this kind of data sharing?
Yeah, we at Sage, we're very fortunate. We're a sub-awardee in the Precision Medicine Initiative, PMI. And so I've been fortunate to be a participant in a lot of the last several months' worth of work on it. And it's both the recruitment cohort of 1 million or more residents of the United States of America, but it's also the technology infrastructure to do the measuring and the dissemination of that data back out to scientists. So it's really interesting to watch how these pieces are coming together. And, you know, things like Blue Button and Sync for Science really piece into this because the concept of this study is kind of unique. It's not simply that we're going to measure people through their phones, which is great, and I've done a bunch of those through Sage. It's not simply that we're going to do a physical exam and get a sample, which is, you know, what the UK Biobank has done. You know, we're not simply going to cull through EHRs like many studies have done. The idea is we're going to bring all those things together so that we have the ability to track the interactions with the medical system through health record synchronization. And we have the ability to do some longitudinal monitoring out in the environment with people's phones or with wearables. Or, you know, the real promise is that the tech platform that supports all of this will be repurposable in many ways to use for lots of follow-on and knock-on studies. We'll have a large enough cohort that's diverse and inclusive enough to actually let us look at rare diseases, understudied populations, And then we'll be able to run these sub-studies, you know, relatively cheaply and relatively profusely because the technical infrastructure is there. And I don't really know what's going to come out of it. That's probably the most exciting thing. You know, what bores me about traditional clinical studies a lot of the time is that we know what's going to happen. And what I find fascinating about the internet, the web, mobile devices as platforms is that the vast majority of the really valuable things that happen on them are things that nobody predicted. And so by building this sort of generic, massive, detailed resource and not predicting exactly what's going to come out of it, we have a chance to bring some of that same, you know, Jonathan Zittrain calls it generativity. We can finally start having that in clinical study.
You know, Margaret didn't mention, but we were fortunate to be selected as one of the 10 health organizations that's part of that NIH initiative. And I want to really give a shout out to Dr. Collins, who's really thinking about it from our vantage point for people who live in poverty, who's the sort of main cohort of the folks that we care for, and obviously racial and ethnic diversity amongst the population. And I was fascinated when you started talking about interpreting tools, because I think that's really going to be something that's going to be important for all the different groups who are going to receive information back. What do I do with this? I was also wondering, because you also at Sage are out on a million lives quest, if I remember correctly. You're out there looking to gather information so that it can be shared. Talk to us a little bit about the work that Sage is doing and where you hope it will take it out in the future.
Sure. So, yeah, when I gave the TED Talk, that was the number that we used, and that remains the number that I think is interesting. It's a nice, clean, round number, and that's always good to help rally support. But it's also probably close enough to start doing some really interesting work. You know, I discovered pretty quickly after we really got into the meat of the project that it was very hard to make informed consent portable so you could just carry it around with you. It's primarily constituted inside a specific clinical study. And so the PMI is a good example of a study that's going to go right at that million number frontally. Mm-hmm. What we've been doing at Sage is a little bit different, which is, you know, we've, over the last couple of years, started running our own clinical studies. We've started hosting clinical studies for others that use Apple's Research Kit framework to enroll through iPhones. We've just gotten into Android in the past month or two with Research Stack as our first foray there, and we'll be adding more there as well. You know, we are in all phases of clinical study at this point. We're working with academics and disease foundations, and we're also working with the pharmaceutical industry and the biotech industry. And what we do is we say within any given study, we want to make sure that individuals have the right to donate a copy of their data to science. And so rather than trying to run this sort of frontally to recruit a million people to do the donation like PMI, it's more that we want to offer people the choice to do a donation inside a study that they're motivated by. So something like our Parkinson's Empower study, where we've enrolled more than 20,000 people in 18 months, we ask them, would you like to have the data stay with us at Sage and with our partners only, or would you like to force us to share it with qualified researchers worldwide? And what we're seeing is generally somewhere between 70 and 75% of participants across all of the studies that we're involved in execute that right and choose to donate a copy of their data to science. Okay. So I think that for us, that's where that million person number is going to come from, is from that percentage of people who decide to prevent whoever's running the study from siloing it off and keeping it as a trade secret. And that's sort of more incremental approach, the more citizen-driven approach. It's just a better map to our resources, our structure. We're a 42-person nonprofit at the moment. That's only four more employees than total awardees in the PMI, because that's what it takes to make the frontal assault and to build that kind of technical infrastructure. And so that's why it's so much fun to be a part of it, is that we can take what we learn at Sage and feed it over to PMI, and we can take what we learn at PMI and feed it over to Sage. And that's a pretty nice way to work.
We've been speaking today with John Wilbanks, Chief Commons Officer at Sage BioNetworks. You can learn more about their work by going to sage-base.org or follow him on Twitter at Wilbanks or Sage Bio. John, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today and for the fascinating contributions you're making to knowledge.
My pleasure.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics.
In the final presidential debate, each candidate misrepresented the other's position on abortion. Let's start with Donald Trump. He claimed that based on what Hillary Clinton was saying, quote, you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb in the ninth month on the final day. First, late-term abortions are rare. Just 1.2% of all the abortions in the United States occur after 20 weeks gestation, according to the Guttmacher Institute, which conducts research on reproductive health. Second, medical experts say there's no such thing as an abortion on the final day or the due date, as Trump described. Daniel Grossman, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of California, San Francisco, told our fact-checking colleagues at PolitiFact that if the mother's life was in danger, the treatment would be delivery. The New York Times similarly quoted the chairman of obstetrics and gynecology at Oregon Health and Science University as saying the scenario Trump described, quote, is not happening in the United States. As for Clinton's position, she has been a staunch defender of abortion rights, but she has said she's open to restrictions on late-term abortions, provided exceptions would be given when the health and life of the mother are an issue. So Trump skewed Clinton's position on late-term abortions. But Clinton also misrepresented Trump's current position. She claimed that Trump said, quote, there should be some form of punishment for women who obtain abortions. He did say that, but he also walked back that statement only hours later. On March 30th, Trump told MSNBC's Chris Matthews that women who get abortions should receive, quote, some form of punishment if the procedure is banned in the United States. He also added that the man who impregnates the woman should not be responsible under the law for the abortion. But on the same day, he put out a statement recanting the punishment claim. He said that if abortion were outlawed, quote, the doctor or any other person performing this illegal act upon a woman would be held legally responsible, not the woman. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. No parent wants to hear their young child's chronic health issues are a result of serious defects requiring complex and risky surgery. But that was exactly the case for 3-year-old Mia Gonzalez, plagued for years with severe life-threatening respiratory issues and multiple hospitalizations. Her doctors discovered the cause was a severe aortic abnormality that would eventually kill her without intervention. Dr. Redmond Burke, head of the pediatric cardiovascular surgery at Nichols Children's Hospital in Miami, would once have deemed her condition inoperable. So he chose a new tactic, create a 3D printed model of her actual heart to offer surgeons a chance to map out an approach to the complex surgery that would not only minimize the high level of risk, but also yield a more hopeful outcome.
This was printed out because she was thought to be inoperable. And by having this type of model, we were able to conceive of an operation that hadn't been done before, connecting the small veins from her lungs up to her heart.
Dr. Burke said he carried the heart around with him for weeks, analyzing the problem from every conceivable angle, sharing ideas with colleagues until they agreed upon the best surgical solution. The surgery ended up being a resounding success.
Her operation was extremely successful, and she's recovering very well in the hospital now, and it's just about ready to go home. And now her life, instead of being measured in terms of days and weeks, is going to be measured in terms of years and decades.
Dr. Burke said that prior to 3D printing technology like this, they would have deemed her case inoperable or at least too risky to chance. This offered a visual problem-solving solution before subjecting his young patient to complications from risky surgery. While scientists say creating stem cell-generated 3D printed organs for implementation is still years away, this method of deploying 3D technology could help surgeons everywhere create workable solutions to complex surgical problems. A 3D printed model of a patient's organ, offering surgeons a visual tool to help tackle complex surgical dilemmas, leading to better surgical outcomes for high-risk patients. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.